his army to fight Imam, but due to the miracle, a heavenly voice comes in the area of Faida, which is between Makkah and Medina, and which will order the earth to open up and swallow these people, and these will get swallowed by the earth. And you said there will be the emergence of Yamani, who is a pious person from Yemen, who will be a revolutionary person against the corruption. And again, there will be a worldwide heavenly voice heard by all the people.
In a Ramadan month.
In the month of Ramadan. And it's believed that this voice will be the voice of Angel Jibreel.
Yeah. Yes, we're still talking about this heavenly voice that actually is being heard in a month of Ramadan before the emergence of Imam. That in this voice, Imam Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam says that beware that such and such is a son of Hujjat ibn al-Hasan al-Askari. He is Imam Mahdi Alayhi Salam. So listen to that and follow it. Again, it's very beautiful that Satan, like every other time, he's active again, even in that time. We have some hadith that say that right after that voice, there will be a second voice.
Wow.
Wow. The second voice is the voice of Shaitan and Satan. We have been asked not to follow the second voice. We have to listen to the first voice. This
All
is
right.
very important, and I think it's nice to know that Satan, like every time that a person tries to start some good thing, comes to actually tempt people and deviate them from the right path.
Yeah.
So
this is our
we
open
have been
enemy.
Asked and told and recommended to follow the
first voice that
introduces Imam Ali Salam and says that he is the Imam of the age and he comes here to save humanity, and then join him and help him and try to assist him. So Satan actually naturally comes to say that, okay, not whatever has been said is not true or something like that.
All right.
Yeah. The next, let's say the last sign, I think, among the five signs of, definite signs of emergence of Imam is martyrdom of Nafs al-Zakiyya. Nafs al-Zakiyya actually means a person, an innocent or pure person who has not committed any murder or any crime.
All right.
So this person actually is an innocent and pure person who is being killed inside the Baytullah al-Haram, that is in Masjid al-Haram,
between
Rukn wal-Maqam, exactly in that area between Rukn and Maqam, those who had the tawfiq to visit the Masjid al-Haram and perform Hajj or Umrah, they know where I'm talking about. That this person is being martyred there, and Imam alayhi salam and Baqir alayhi salam in a lengthy hadith talks about that. That he says that this young guy actually talks about the reappearance of Imam. At the end of this lengthy hadith, Imam says that when this young guy actually invites people to join Imam and to help and assist Imam, they come and kill and martyr this pure and innocent person. Based on some hadith, from the time that this person is getting martyred till the reappearance of the Imam lasts only 15 nights.
All right, so there's just a 15 nights gap between the reappearance of Imam and the martyrdom of Nafs al-Zakiyya. Thank you so much, Dr. Alevi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners.
Welcome.
You were listening to IRIB English Radio.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States is drumming up support from regional nations in East and West Asia to unite under alliances against Washington's perceived threats. According to a Wall Street Journal report, the U.S. held secret meetings with senior Israeli and Arab military figures, namely from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain at the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh in March. The talks were focused on Iran. Washington has been mulling the idea of forming a regional alliance against Tehran by bringing those with strained relations with Iran closer to Israel for quite some time now. The Abraham Accords, under which several Arab nations normalized their ties with Israel, is widely believed to have been part of the plan. This is while Iran is taking diplomatic steps to strengthen ties with its regional neighbors, which may include some of the very nations that are being considered by Washington as potential anti-Tehran allies. The Islamic Republic and Saudi Arabia have been engaged in talks aimed at the normalization of their bilateral relations over the past few months. Iranian and Emirati officials have also expressed willingness to restore warmer ties in recent months.
What we can observe is the world as a whole is moving towards a more multipolar world where countries are not afraid to be in relationship with one another despite U.S. interests. And we see this happening all throughout the world. And we can simply look to the summit of the, because that was a failed attempt at the U.S. to kind of bully itself into remaining and enforcing its U.S. hegemony in other places throughout the world. And so with recent events that have been happening around the world, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the U.S. trying to again impose U.S. hegemony in other places throughout the world, we see countries moving further and further away from U.S. interests and really focusing on building with one another in the best interests of their own countries.
That poses some serious questions about the effectiveness of a potential U.S.-backed regional anti-Iran coalition. North Korea has accused the United States of trying to set up a NATO-style military alliance in Asia, saying Washington continues to hold military maneuvers with East Asian states despite Pyongyang's warnings. In a statement posted on its official website on Sunday, North Korea's foreign ministry said Washington is making a, quote, full-fledged move to establish an Asia-style NATO while blatantly holding joint military exercises with Japan and South Korea. The remarks come on the heels of recent joint exercises by the U.S., South Korean, and Japanese forces, which involved a U.S. aircraft carrier for the first time in more than 4 years. In a meeting after the drills, North Korean officials condemned aggressive moves by Washington and Seoul, pledging to take revenge on the U.S. imperialists as they mark the 72nd anniversary of the outbreak of the Korean War. Why is it that Washington prefers setting up military deterrence when it can resolve conflicts through diplomatic means? Wouldn't that be a less costly and more efficient way of diffusing tensions?
We live in a world where, with all the nuances in North Korea, with all the misinformation that we are told about North Korea, the U.S. is trying to create fear without actual evidence. So what we can expect in upcoming months is that the U.S. is going to try to make it seem as if North Korea is the aggressor, as if they are not doing military exercises right outside of North Korea's borders, to provoke and to create the conditions to justify military actions and military exercises against the people in North Korea that have chosen to continue to build their country in favor of a one Korea and reuniting their countries and moving away from U.S. Interests.
The history of U.S.-led alliances, including that of NATO, shows that more often than not, they fail to accomplish their self-declared objectives. It wouldn't come as a surprise if newer ones won't have a different fate.
Strikes in Europe's transport sector have disrupted air flights and train schedules as transportation companies struggle to cope with rising demand at the start of the peak of summer travel season after COVID restrictions were lifted. A strike by staff members at Irish Airline, Ryanair, and Brussels Airlines over pay and working conditions forced the cancellation of many flights. The workers' strike also disrupted flight schedules in Spain, Italy, France, Portugal, and Belgium. Meanwhile, earlier this week, the British railway system once again came to a halt. Tens of thousands of workers have walked in Britain's biggest rail strike in 30 years, with millions of passengers facing days of chaos as both the unions and the government have stuck to their guns in a row over pay. The British Transport Union, the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers, RMT, threatened to continue the industrial action until managers address the workers' grievances and meet their salary demands. According to the UK government career service, RMT members who are not high earners, for example train guards and track maintenance staff, earn somewhere between £20,000 to £35,000. But the union says its members deserve more. Despite the ongoing negotiations between representatives from the management and staff, the media predicted the strikes to continue. They attributed further industrial action to the rapidly rising inflation rates exacerbated by sluggish economic growth, saying this combo will likely lead to more worker strikes across the European continent in the summer ahead.
The people who are on strike have been pretty clear about it, including in Great Britain with the railroads, the airline pilots, and everybody else. For some years, they've been in trouble and there have been increasing social unrest. And what's happening now is a huge increase in inflation and hence a decrease in purchasing power, and people's standard of living is going down. And so you're having a confluence of events. You have this economic crisis, then you have this people saying, listen, we cannot let the war in Ukraine completely derail the environmental crisis. And furthermore, the policies, as another group saying, look, the policies that we're pursuing, that our governments are pursuing in Ukraine, are adding to the problem, not making it better.
Unions have said the rail strikes could mark the start of a summer of discontent, with teachers, medics, and even waste disposal workers heading for industrial action as inflation pushes 10%. Inflation has soared across Europe on the back of a major rise in energy costs, and Britain is not alone in facing strikes. Russia's war in Ukraine pushed the already rising inflation in countries that use the euro to a record high in May, with energy projected to have the steepest annual rate. As the war in Ukraine drags on through its fourth month, the West, led by US and NATO, remains largely united in backing Kiev, but they are divided over how long they're willing to endure the conflict's economic fallout. The prospect of a drawn-out conflict with the battle raging in eastern Ukraine has raised questions about whether war fatigue, coupled with skyrocketing food prices and energy bills, could test countries' political will to keep pressuring Moscow over time. In the U.S., President Joe Biden blamed the Russians for rising U.S. gas prices, saying it was outrageous what the war in Ukraine is causing. Hungary, on the other hand, has called for immediate peace talks to end the war between Ukraine and Russia, warning that a prolonged conflict will fuel an economic crisis that will imperil governments across Europe. Meanwhile, the United Nations has warned of an unprecedented global hunger crisis in light of the recent developments.
There's a couple of different things going on here. There is the United States as an outlier in NATO in a certain sense, with some of the Eastern European companies really pushing for more and more aggressive behavior by NATO in Ukraine. You have other countries which are in Western Europe who are suffering from the United States activities here, the real pressure. Economically, and are beginning to say, wait a minute, this is not what we really want to have here. Our population's getting upset. And then you have apparently the failure of the sanctions. And in the United States press, at least, the understanding that maybe they're not going to work so well. And so the Russians are not going to be suffering so much.
Western countries rallied around Kiev when Russia began its military operation in Ukraine in February. But now that unity is being tested as soaring inflation and energy shortages rebound on their own citizens. Now, the UN Human Rights Office agrees that the veteran Palestinian journalist was killed by Israeli fire last month. The probe finds that Abu Akleh and her colleague were targeted by seemingly well-aimed bullets as they covered a military raid in the occupied West Bank.
All the information we have gathered, including official documentation from the Israeli military and the Palestinian Attorney General, is consistent with the finding that the shots that killed Abu Akleh and injured her colleague came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians, as was initially claimed by the Israeli authorities.
So far, several media organizations have conducted their own investigations into the incident, and all have come to the same conclusion. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probe, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the fingers at Israel from the outset. The UN has also confirmed that Abu Akleh was wearing a blue flak jacket marked with the word press when being shot by Israeli troops, exposing the gruesome nature of the daylight murder and suggesting that they were deliberately targeted.
As long as the United States and its allies continue to not only embrace this position, but to promote this position using every tactic at their disposal, including threats, the more that has been the case, the more the occupation is quite happy to resort to war crimes bordering on what one could also say are crimes against humanity, albeit in a very calculated move, drawn out over a period of decades, as is the case with ethnic cleansing, which if it happened over a shorter period of time, would fit very nicely with the definition of a genocide.
The killing of yet another journalist is, however, in line with the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. Israeli brutality against Palestinians and journalists has been a topic of discussion for many years now. The regime has, however, never accepted blame for its wrongdoing, and in nearly all cases baselessly shifted the blame on Palestinians, and the case of Abu Akleh is no exception. Following the UN's report, the Israeli regime insisted that the fatal shooting of Abu Akleh was unintentional, pointing out at the same time that it had not received access to critical evidence that might determine whether she was killed by an Israeli soldier or a Palestinian gunman. Israel's military also says Palestinian authorities should hand over the bullet that killed Shireen. The demand has, however, been met by widespread criticism, with Palestinians saying the regime should hand over the gun, which is believed to have killed the journalist, as Israel can't be trusted of conducting a fair investigation of itself. The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel for its occupation and blockades of the coastal enclave. Yet, no one, including the UNSC, has used any of its tools to ensure resolutions related to ending the Israeli siege imposed on Gaza have been implemented.
The complete lack of accountability only encourages, as we have seen, more war crimes by the occupation. And the unfortunate that the position long taken by the number one sponsor of the occupation, the United States of America, is that Palestinians and Israelis should resolve their differences through negotiation, and in both instances should be prevented from invoking international law and the institutions which administer it in order to impose a solution in keeping with their respective legal obligations in this so-called rules-based international order. And that, of course, is really quite absurd.
Instead, many of the UNSC member states have doubled their support for Israel, despite its blockade and bombardment of Gaza and murdering dozens of innocent women and children. Some even increased their support for the regime and obliged neighboring countries to forge ties with it. And in absence of action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against the Palestinians, whether a journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the European Union and NATO are gathering a coalition for war with Moscow. This after the EU unanimously granted candidacy status to Ukraine and Moldova. Lavrov drew parallels between current-day events and those of the first half of the 20th century when Germany was preparing an attack on the Soviet Union.
When the Second World War was about to start, Hitler gathered most of the European countries under his banners. Now the EU and NATO are also gathering the same modern coalition for the fight, and by and large for war with the Russian Federation. We will look at this very carefully.
Lavrov's remarks came after the EU leaders stepped up rhetoric against Russia.
EU's decision strengthens Ukraine and Moldova in the face of Russian aggression.
A confrontation between Moscow and NATO's nuclear-armed members would have catastrophic consequences for Europe. After all, Europe would be the immediate theater of such a war.
In terms of the possibilities of war, NATO fighting a war with Russia, I don't think they are very good. First of all, because the United States will not suffer as a result of this war. The Europeans will suffer. The Europeans, if they start down this path, they will unleash a nuclear war, in which case their entire, all of the NATO countries will be destroyed. All of the NATO bases, it will be a catastrophe for these people. And I think the leaders of the three major countries, Germany, France, and Italy, I think they understand this. And I think that's why they have been going to Kiev to have discussions with President Zelensky. They know that the people, this is not in their interest.
Candidate status is only the first step on the path to EU membership, which can take decades. But putting the EU action in the context of the current state of affairs, we can see that the rising escalation might quickly lead to catastrophic consequences. Tensions are also increasing between the EU and Russia over the growing Kaliningrad crisis. This after Lithuania began enforcing the EU sanctions and restricted the transit of goods to Kaliningrad. Moscow says the move amounts to a blockade of its exclave and has warned of serious consequences.
As for retaliatory measures and what they will be like, will they be exclusively in the diplomatic dimension? The answer is no. They will not be in the diplomatic dimension. They will be practical.
A move by Russia on Lithuania would clearly trigger NATO's Article 5 mutual defense provision, immediately pulling in all the alliance's members to a potential nuclear war with Russia. But how far can the Europeans really push for such an escalatory path with Russia, especially at a time when they are experiencing an energy crisis?
If you're asking me personally, I personally think that the main reason for the war in the Ukraine was to block the alliance between Germany and Russia. And the symbol of that alliance was the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which never got opened. As a result, now Germany is in a critical crisis because Russia has control of its energy. Russia just dialed down 40% of its energy. Germany cannot survive under these conditions. It is not in Germany's interest to commit suicide for the United States of America.
On Thursday, Ukraine said it had received U.S. supplies of high-mobility artillery rocket systems, a powerful long-range weapon system that Kiev hopes can help turn the tide on Russia's military offensive. Russian officials have repeatedly warned that the U.S. decision to supply Ukraine with advanced rocket systems could exacerbate the conflict.
In the limelight.
Children rummage through Deir al-Balah Dump on a constant basis. Among them is an 11-year-old called Fadi. He goes to the dump located in central Gaza after school each day. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ola Musam, writer. This article is published under the heading Danger doesn't stop children from working in Gaza's dumps. Stay tuned for more. Children rummage through Deir al-Balah's dump on a constant basis. Among them is an 11-year-old called Fadi. He goes to the dump located in central Gaza after school each day. "We have no choice," says his father Mustafa, who accompanies Fadi as they research for material they can retrieve and sell to recycling plants, adding, "If we don't do this, we will starve to death." Mustafa, a mechanic, has been unemployed for 7 years now. Both he and Fadi have been injured while working at the dump. The dangers of this work were demonstrated earlier this year. In January, Osama al-Sarsik, 14, died at a dump in Johr al-Lik, south of Gaza City. Osama had gone to work at the dump with his father, Arafat. Together, they would collect any plastic and metal, particularly copper and aluminum, they could sell. "We had to make a living. It was a cold, rainy day," Arafat said, adding, "but the weather didn't stop us. We had to make a living." They had been at the dump for approximately 2 hours when Arafat realized that Osama was missing. Arafat's first thought was that his son had been attacked by dogs. Osama's body was found following a lengthy search, and it was determined that he died from traumatic asphyxia. Arafat relies on his meager earnings from collecting recyclable material to feed his family. For the past 4 years, he has had no other source of income. Osama was the eldest of his 5 children. The child's death prompted the Gaza municipality to ban the public from accessing the dump. The ban was contested by a number of people who depend on collecting reusable or recyclable waste for a living. According to Marwan Al-Ghul, an official with the municipality, most people who collect material from the dump are unaware of how dangerous their work can be. He said, "They are just trying to make ends meet. We are trying to find a solution urgently, especially because child labor is increasing due to the Zionist regime's blockade." Omar, a father of 7, has refused to stop collecting waste from dumps. 2 of his sons, aged 18 and 10, work with him. He said, "Sometimes I am not able to provide enough food for my family." A blacksmith by training, Omar has long been unemployed. By collecting waste, he only makes a small sum, up to $9 per day. "When I started doing this work, I felt ashamed," he said, adding, "but I no longer do. No one can stop me from scavenging. The officials want to stop us, but I and many others will keep doing this work. I don't want to do it, but I also don't want my children to starve." The latest available data from the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics suggests that less than 1% of Gaza's children aged between 10 and 17 do either paid or unpaid work. Gaza's Social Development Ministry, nonetheless, believes that child labor is on the rise due to the Zionist regime's blockade. Earlier this year, the ministry undertook a survey of 10,000 families in various parts of Gaza with an income of less than $250. The survey, so far unpublished, found that 60% of parents who responded would be willing to have their children working as a last resort. Child labor in Gaza is the result of poverty, the Israeli regime blockade, and unemployment, said Iman Omar, a social worker with the ministry. Most of the children who work also go to school. They work with their fathers or brothers in dumps or selling things, he said. Sharif Nine collects plastic material, empty cans, and other metals from Gaza's streets every day. As his father is dead, Sharif works to support his family. He said, "And I want to save enough money so that I can buy a smartphone. And all my schoolmates have smartphones and they watch soap operas and cartoons. We don't have a computer or a phone in our home." Another boy doing similar work is 11-year-old Husam. His father has a disability and has long been unemployed. Street cleaners and other people have tried to stop Husam from collecting material, but he has kept doing so. He loads all the plastic and metals that he gathers from dumps and from streets onto a cart, which his older brother then brings to a recycling plant. The only significant precaution he takes is that he avoids dumps near hospitals out of fear he will be contaminated by discarded syringes. Along with his brother, Husam can make about $6 per day. He goes to a dump early each morning in the hope that he will be the first person there. Husam said, "Some days I cannot collect anything. That's because there are so many other children and even adults doing this kind of work."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, good manner. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the good manner in the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about good manner, it has a general meaning and it has a specific meaning. When we look at the Islamic text, we see that its general meaning is to have good characteristics in yourself, which can help your soul to go towards the perfection. But when it refers to a specific meaning, it means to have kindness with the people. It means to have a good behavior with the people. It means to socialize with the people in a good manner. And you become a person who's been seen as a good person in the society. This is what it specifically means in the Islamic teachings. If we look around us, we can see that there are many people who look good as their appearance. They have a good appearance. They have a good clothing. Maybe the way they talk, it's impressive or it's attractive. But on the other hand, whenever something happens to them, maybe some mishappening is happening, we see that the characteristics that we have made in our mind, the picture that we had of that person in our mind, it's been destroyed, and we see another person over there. Therefore, when in the Islamic perspective we talk about the good manner, it means that in all kinds, in all ways, in all scenarios, the person should have the kindness in himself. He should be behaving in a good way so that whenever people see him, they love that person. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of good manner in the Islamic lifestyle, and we said that the good manner in its specific meaning has a special meaning. Whereas we can also see that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, when he talks about the good manner, which is known as husn khulq in the Arabic terminology or other the Islamic terms, we see that he says that husn khulq or the good manner is something that when you are facing someone, you face him in a soft way. You face him with purification. You face him with kindness. And whenever your brothers in iman, when they see you, even if you are in the hard time, they see you as a person who is relaxed, as a person who never leaves his kindness to the people. And he always pay attention to the manners that he must observe. It doesn't matter whether there was a mishap with him. It doesn't matter whether someone has insulted him. Because in the history, if we see, we also see that there was a guy who came from Syria to Medina, and he was abusing and using bad words for Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam. And whereas Imam Hassan, when he faced him and he saw him like he's abusing and he's insulting Imam, he never said anything. Rather, he said, "It looks like you're a passenger and you're a traveler. You need a place to sleep. Your clothes are dirty. You need some place to wash your clothes, to have a bath. You need a clean place to sleep, so I can provide everything to you." So this was the manner of Imam Hassan, which changed that guy who came and who was from the enemies of Imam Hassan, and later he became from the lovers of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
in the limelight.
It is now history, in fact, glorious history, how the U.S. continued to fail in its devilish designs, how its agents, the MKO hypocrites, have suffered humiliation after humiliation as terroristic traitors, and how Saddam eventually vanished from the scene in utter disgrace, while today the power and prestige of the Islamic Republic of Iran is paramount all over the region and beyond, including amongst our Iraqi brethren with whom Washington had tried to create bad blood, says Kayhan, international staff writer, in an article published under the heading, How the U.S. Continued to Fail in Its Devilish Designs. Stay tuned for more. On the 7th of the Iranian month of Tir, corresponding with June 28, Iran commemorated the 41st martyrdom anniversary of Chief Justice Ayatollah Sayyid Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, whom the U.S. had assassinated through its agents in Tehran, along with 72 revolutionary figures, including cabinet ministers and members of parliament, in a vain bid to overthrow the Islamic Republic in the midst of the devastating war that the American stooge Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad had imposed as part of the same nefarious goal. It is now history, in fact, glorious history, how the U.S. continued to fail in its devilish designs, how its agents, the MKO hypocrites, have suffered humiliation after humiliation as terroristic traitors, and how Saddam eventually vanished from the scene in utter disgrace, while today the power and prestige of the Islamic Republic of Iran is paramount all over the region and beyond, including amongst our Iraqi brethren with whom Washington had tried to create bad blood. The keys to the chain of success of Islamic Iran, which over the past four decades has achieved self-sufficiency in all fields, including medicine, aerospace, nanotechnology, the nuclear fuel cycle for peaceful progress, the cyber world, artificial intelligence, and military industries, are indeed the spirit of resistance and the courage to court martyrdom for safeguarding of humanitarian principles. It is obvious that a cowardly satanic regime like that of the U.S. cannot defeat the godly values which Iran espouses for the promotion of peace, stability, and a region fearlessly resisting imperialism, terrorism, Zionism, and all hegemonic plots. This is fully evident today throughout the neighborhood where in Syria the people and the government stand tall after years of resistance to defeat the macabrely murderous terrorists of various hues and colors unleashed by the U.S., the illegal Zionist entity, reactionary Arab regimes, and Turkey in a vain attempt to balkanize that country. In Iraq, which used to be the bastion of brutality of the despicable Ba'athist, it is people's will at the ballot boxes, under guidance of the religious leaders and in harmony with the patriotic popular mobilization forces that governs the country, even though the remnants of the U.S. occupiers who precariously cling to a few illegal military bases despite the verdict of the parliament for their exit are trying to prevent formation of a broad-based government, In Lebanon, the resistance forces led by the legendary anti-terrorism movement, the Hezbollah, have again emerged as the largest single group in the recent elections to ensure establishment of yet another independent government in a further blow to the divisive forces backed by the US and Saudi Arabia. In occupied Palestine, the Israeli usurpers, in spite of their inhuman atrocities against the sons of the soil, are clearly living on borrowed time and might implode any moment as the clocks tick fast for the day of destiny, thanks to the indomitable spirit of resistance of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other patriotic groups. In Yemen, the popular Ansarullah movement heads the legitimate government in Sana'a with firm faith in God Almighty and confident of the people's resistance that safeguards the independence of the greater part of the country in the face of the savagery of the US-backed Saudi and Emirati invaders whose unmanly acts of state terrorism have been countered with a steady barrage of indigenously built ballistic missiles and drones, not on civilian centers, but on military industrial installations. In Bahrain, the repressive Al Khalifa regime of pirate origin is at its wits' end, and no matter how humiliatingly it clings to the aprons of the US fleet and how humbly it licks the boots of the Zionists, it cannot delay for long the democratic aspirations of the Bahraini people based on Islamic resistance. In short, throughout the region, client regimes are facing simmering resistant revolutionary forces which will soon emerge to root out US hegemony, which is on the way out in Pakistan and even in Turkey. As for Afghanistan, 40 years ago, the country was under occupation of the Soviet Union, which has long disintegrated, while the US occupation that followed also recently ended after two disastrous decades, all of which is proof of the fact that Americanism has miserably failed. Thus, it was not for no reason that in 1981, following the June 28 dastardly blast in Tehran, the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had hailed as a nation unto our nation, Martyr Beheshti, whose immortal words continue to ring in our ears. O U.S., be angry with us and perish in this state of anger.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. He would not do things without calculating them first. And when he reached a result in that calculation, he would put it into action with complete decisiveness. There was no doubt and weaknesses in his work. He would never become disappointed. So many incidents occurred in the first year of the revolution, the martyrdom of many people and various other issues, but this never made him disappointed. He was honest in the literal sense of the word. He was honest with both God and the people. He would honor his promises. When he came to Tehran in the year 1357, Bahman 12, he said that he would form a government. The speech in Behesht-e-Zahra, and he formed the government 4 days later. During those 4 days, he summoned the Revolutionary Council, and we went there. Apparently, he had asked some members of the Revolutionary Council, Shahid Mutahari, Shahid Beheshti, and the like, to find someone, but they had not managed to find a person yet. Imam was upset about that. He criticized them for not having taken action. He was like that.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
He was really disciplined and punctual. I myself witnessed this in many cases. He was a man who would rely on God in the real sense of the word. He believed in divine promises and was confident about them. And whoever puts their trust in God, then he alone is sufficient for them. This is Holy Quran, chapter 65, verse 3. He was the true embodiment of this ayah. He was a warrior. Later, I will explain what this means. He had such characteristics. Of course, he had other exemplary qualities as well. These were his personal qualities. As for his school of thought, principles, and goals, if we wish to briefly explain the foundation of Imam's school of thought and revolution, we must say that the foundation for all his activities was rising up for the cause of God. The goal was to rise for the cause of God.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. You've done
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Afghan people affected by the earthquake in southeastern Afghanistan are grappling with dire situations. Hundreds of families are living in the open, out of fear that there may be further tremors.
For the sake of God, please help us survive this catastrophe. The earthquake has devastated our houses and livelihoods. We live outdoors. During the night, it rains very heavily. I'm afraid these harsh conditions will further harm my only surviving family members. In addition, we don't have enough food and cash.
In the meantime, the affected people in Paktika and Khost provinces say that the provided aid is not sufficient.
We thank the Afghan government and charities for assisting us with humanitarian aid, but they are not sufficient as thousands of our people in several districts have been affected by the deadly earthquake. There are a lot of children who are awaiting food and wounded people who are in dire need of medication. We ask them to scale up their assistance to our people, especially food, drinking water, and tents.
The Afghan health minister, in a press conference in Kabul on Monday, warned that the survivors of the earthquake are at risk of diseases, including mental problems.
This is very true that affected people are also exposed to getting sick. Some are getting mental or psychological illnesses because they have lost everything, including their loved ones. Some people, especially children, are at risk of malnourishment and other diseases. I call on the international community to help us stave off the disaster and create a safe situation for them to live on.
So far, the United Nations and several neighboring countries have rushed aid to the devastated areas, but helping thousands of victims remains a challenge for the foreign countries due to the U.S. restrictions imposed on the country following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has been facing multiple humanitarian crises in the past decades. The recent earthquake is a reminder that the war-torn country should not be forgotten by the global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's new parliament has been inaugurated, and many expect the next 5 years will be turbulent. President Emmanuel Macron was reprimanded at the ballot box, losing his absolute majority. He then failed to cobble together a coalition, leaving France with a so-called hung parliament. Each different bill will now have to find its own majority to become enacted, although since 2012, French presidents have often resorted to executive decrees to pass unpopular, austerity-minded legislation. Many also speculate that if Parliament doesn't work in his favor, that Macron could call for new elections in maybe a matter of months.
He's not going to be able to do anything to make any reform because it's going to be completely blocked between the extreme right wing and the Mélenchon team, which are completely opposite. And so I believe that not much is going to happen during the next 5 years, which will give rise to, you know, more extreme positions in the future.
The far-right national rally, led by Marine Le Pen, won a record 15% of seats. Islamophobia has already been obvious in France's judicial and presidential branches, and now it's widely present in their legislative branch.
We now have an assembly which better represents the range of public opinion. The president will stay in his assigned role of a sort of republican monarch. We'll see more debate, and that might produce more reforms.
A clear improvement is an increased number of working-class legislators, thanks to the NUPES leftist coalition, but even more so because of the